This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. At the same time as we broadcast, we stream live at prairiepublic.org, and the show is archived at the same place as Main Street, so the record goes on. And today we're going to start with somebody who knows a bit about radio because he currently does it. He knows a bit about a fair number of things. David White Thunder Trottier, he longtime chair of the board of directors of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. He joins us from our studio in Grand Forks. Thanks for being with us, David.
Thank you, Doug. Thank you for having me. I'm glad to be here.
I touched a bit on your resume. Why don't you fill it out for our listeners?
From what standpoint?
Well, from where you got to the State Arts Board.
Okay. All right. I have a long background in the arts, going all the way back to childhood when my father got me interested in it and in the schools that I did school plays in elementary school, and didn't have theater in my high school. And actually, I was taking a French class, and my French teacher was also an English teacher, and they were doing a melodrama, and she got all distraught one day and said, "My villain quit." Well, in the melodrama, that's a pretty important character. So I looked at her and kind of tilted my head, and I thought, that can't be that hard. I said, "I'll do it." She said, "You will?" Show was the next day. I said, "Yeah, I will."
You're a quick study then, David.
Yeah, well, back then, young and not really knowing what I was getting into, so she gave me a script, and I took off from that class to the library, started working on my lines, that and after school, and had a rehearsal that night. I didn't know what blocking was then, so I made up my own movements on the stage, as I called them, and did a show the next afternoon for the school, and did a show the following night for the community, did two performances, and didn't miss a line.
And you were bitten by the bug, I take it.
Well, I had been bitten by the bug, actually, as a child. My best friend growing up, Bob Johnson from Fort Totten, his mom, Beth Johnson, founded Fort Totten Little Theater in Fort Totten. And in 1963, when they were doing Oklahoma, and Bob and I were 7 years old, his mom opened the door, pointed to two empty seats, and said, "You boys go sit in there and behave yourselves." So we did. And watching the production up on stage for me as a seven-year-old, wide-eyed, and I was like I was at a Hollywood production. And then they kissed on stage. And I turned to my friend Bob, and I thought, how do they dare kiss in front of all these people? And he said, "That's a real kiss, too." So that was really when the bug got me, was at an early age, and I carried it for a long time. But my high school didn't do plays except for that one opportunity. But by the time I got to college at Mayville State University, where I went to play football, actually, and at spring of my freshman year, I went to the show they were doing on stage, which was Damn Yankees, and they looked like they were having so much fun out there. And I said to myself, I'm going to do this next year, too. So the next year, I started trying out for plays and got bit parts as a sophomore, bigger parts as a junior, and lead roles as a senior, where I won Best Actor in a Play as a senior and Best Actor in a Musical as a senior.
Well, and you were brought back to Mayville State to be inducted into their Hall of Fame.
Absolutely. I was put into the Distinguished Alumni Hall back in 2002, same year I was their commencement speaker. And I was also inducted into their Performing Arts Hall of Fame in 2017. A great, great honor, along with who I consider my theater mentor and arts mentor, Dr. Christopher Jones.
Well, let's go back in history in another way now. And when that call came from you from the office of the late Governor George Sinner, that's a long time ago now. Tell us about joining the Arts Council.
It certainly is, Doug. I had moved back to North Dakota in the early 80s and continued doing theater like I did wherever I lived in Michigan and Kansas. And when I came back to North Dakota, got involved in it again, was living in the Devil's Lake area and got involved with the Pioneer Players. And I was being in shows and directing shows and ended up president of the Pioneer Players and was sitting home one night and my phone rang and it was someone from Governor George Sinner's office. And they said, "Governor Sinner would like to appoint you to an unexpired term on the North Dakota Council on the Arts." I shook my head and said, "Are you sure you have the right guy?" And I found I'd be saying that a lot in my life over the next 30 years.
Wow, and 22 years ago this year, Governor Ed Schaefer appointed you as chairman of the North Dakota Council on the Arts.
Yes, Howard Dahl was the chair right before I was. Very distinguished fellow. Absolutely love Howard, great guy. And he didn't want another turn. He was getting busy in his business. And I was actually on a business trip down to Colorado, and my phone rang again, my cell phone that I had at the time, and it was someone from Governor Schaefer's office who said, Governor Schaefer would like to appoint you to chair position. And again, I said, are you sure you have the right guy?
Well, and you mentioned this business trip. You are also the former CEO of Chiptronics Incorporated. What kind of a incorporation was that?
That is an electronics distribution and manufacturing company that was located in Dunseith. I became involved with them all the way back in 1992 when I became involved and became president and became one of the owners, and was affiliated with the company all the way up until 2007 when I retired from that, and actually planned on leaving the area. But Chiptronics Incorporated went from $5 million in sales to $41 million in sales in about 10 years. We did electronic manufacturing, printed circuit card assemblies, wiring harness assemblies. Our biggest customer in those years was IBM.
And the White Thunder name, David White Thunder Trottier, you have a tribal connection.
I do. I am a member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe in Fort Yates through my mother, who was a full-blood member of the Standing Rock Sioux Tribe. Her maiden name was White Thunder. And through the historical things that go on in the lives of people that were my parents' age at the Indian mission schools that were located on the reservations, her name was put into her mind that it was not a good name because she really didn't know who her father was. And she grew up with a little bit of disdain for that name. And when I got a little older, I looked up the name and I said, Mom, it's a very proud name. As a matter of fact, I said, he was a pipe carrier for our people. I said, I want you to give me that name. I said, and if you give me that name, I'll make it a name you can be proud of, and I'll carry it for the rest of my life. And about 2 years ago, I was given the name in ceremony by a very distinguished man from the Standing Rock Reservation.
And currently, you are a radio show host at a Rugby FM station, KKWZ 95.3, Adult Contemporary Radio.
That is one of the stations that we have in Rugby, and becoming affiliated with Rugby Broadcasters and Lila Harstead, who's the sole female owner of a radio station in North Dakota, by the way. And we actually have two stations, or stations are three frequencies. It's AM, FM, KZZJ, AM 1450, and 92.1 FM, where I do have my morning show every morning from 6 to 10. And KKWZ is the adult contemporary station where I spend a few hours on the air 3 or 4 days a week as well. But my main show is on the AM, on KZZJ, on the AM and the 92.1 FM.
So tell us about that show. What do you talk about?
It is a typical small-town radio show in ag country. We do a lot of farm broadcasting, farm reporting. We do some two-on-two stuff. From 6 to 8, I'm joined by the news guy, Bruce Allen, who's been in radio for his whole career, over 40 years. And we banter back and forth a little bit, do a little teasing, which I like to do. And some of it becomes entertaining sometimes for the local listeners, but it's a lot of fun. I like to have fun. I think laughter is a very good thing for people, and so I try to get it as much as I can to get it out to our listeners.
You apparently like music, too, because you've composed more than 100 original songs.
Absolutely. And when I moved out to Michigan in 1979, I knew a few chords on the guitar, and I was out there by myself, and it was before I started doing theater, and I said to myself, I'm going to go buy a guitar so I can learn to play a little more. So I went and bought a guitar. And I started buying sheet music with the chords on it because I didn't read music. And I didn't like how I sounded because I was trying to sound like Gordon Lightfoot, and I was trying to sound like Jim Croce and Harry Chapin and the guys that I really liked their music of. And I thought, if I write my own songs, nobody can say, hey, that doesn't sound like Gordon, because it would be my own. So that's how I started writing songs. And I knew I had the background in English because my degree is in English from Mayville State. And so it came pretty easy. And I learned eventually, about the chord progressions and the different keys of songs that I was writing in. And I couldn't stop. I just kept writing and writing and writing. And actually made a record in 1986 on a 45, the last of the 45s, and got it out on the radio for a little while.
Well, let's get back to the North Dakota Council on the Arts, because you served 30 years on that board, and most of them as the chair of the board. So how would you characterize the state of the arts in North Dakota?
I think the state of the arts from the artist's standpoint is very strong. My service on the arts has seen so many different changes that have come about because I actually served over half of the existence of the National Endowment of the Arts and over half of the existence of the North Dakota Council on the Arts. We've had swings up and down. The oil boom was great for the arts as well, too. But we have so many strong, talented, committed people to the arts in North Dakota that makes us a very strong state. But we're considered a rural state because of our population. So sometimes, you know, the numbers can get a little down and things like that. But I feel as an arts state and an arts-minded state that we are very strong.
We're talking with David White Thunder Trottier. He's served as the chair of the board of directors of the North Dakota Council on the Arts starting in 1990. So he has an overview of the picture of the arts that few people do in North Dakota. What are the challenges as you see them, David, to growing the arts in North Dakota?
One of the challenges that still exists to this day, and it's always been, is, you know, there's never enough money for the arts. And I always said, I wish, you know, for the people that apply for grants, that want grants, that, you know, we try to get as much out there as we can, but there never seems to be enough money to meet all the grant requests that we have. And that is something that's always been a challenge for the arts. And back then, 10 years ago, 15, and even today, it's a challenge for the arts. There's more people that want to get involved and want to do this than what there is money to go around. And that becomes, yeah, that's been a long-term challenge.
Well, I know that the Council on the Arts has a budget of roughly $1.5 million, and about half of that comes from the state. The other half comes from the National Endowment for the Arts. Is money the biggest issue?
I would say for the most part, yes, it is. Because the other challenge that we have is every now and then someone comes along in Washington that wants to shut down the arts, shut down the humanities.
Or somebody in the legislature.
Or somebody in the legislature on the state level as well, too, yes, that has a problem with money being spent for the art. And it's all in how they frame it. It's all in how they frame it. I was reading somewhere where someone wrote at one time that the Arts Council was giving money to a lady to teach her how to dye Easter eggs. On the surface, there's a little bit of truth to that, but what these eggs were a very culturally significant eggs to the Ukrainian culture called Pysanky eggs.
And they're very wonderful pieces of art.
Very painstakingly painted, hand-painted, and yes, they are wonderful, beautiful pieces of art. So it's not dying Easter eggs. It's preserving a part of the culture that's very important to them. That happens to be one of my favorite stories in the Arts Council over the years. Why is arts important? Preservation of culture is part of it. The Ukrainian Cultural Institute out in western North Dakota worked very hard to do that. A lady, Agnes Palahniuk, who actually won a Governor's Award for the Arts for her work, they went back to the Ukraine to see how they were doing preserving their culture. The culture over there had been so suppressed out of their culture that they go over there now to teach them about the culture of the Ukraine.
Well,
as a result of that.
Your length of time in the state has probably informed you about how these kinds of things keep coming back. So what is your best argument when somebody says that? What does David White Thunder Trottier say to someone who says, you know, this is just low-hanging fruit, let's pull it down and move on with stuff that our money could be better spent on?
Well, I get a lot of times when people ask me about who the arts applies to, who the arts is for, and all that, and my answer for that is very simple. I say, do you put on a pair of shoes every day? And if they say yes, I said, those were designed by an artist. Do you wear clothes? Yes, those were designed by an artist. Do you have things hanging on your wall in your house? Yes, those were designed by an artist. Art touches everybody's lives, no matter what. No matter what their cultural affiliation is, no matter what their financial situation is, art touches their lives. And is it important to people? Why do we buy children little toys to play with? Because we want to develop their senses. Developing the senses is so important. That's what the arts does. That's what the arts continues to do. Nothing fosters creativity better than the arts.
And you mentioned the Ukrainian Easter eggs, and of course you mentioned your Standing Rock connections. Arts are very important to distinguish cultures as well.
Absolutely. And in North Dakota in particular, where I believe we have about a 10 or 11% of our population is Native American in this state, and we want to get out there and preserve those cultures because, as you know, throughout history, you know, the it was the policy of the United States government to eliminate Native people, to eliminate the cultures. Mm-hmm. And even in my lifetime, when I was going to mission schools when I was little, there was still a lot of that was going on. It wasn't until the early 70s that Native language started coming back and being taught in the schools because it had almost been killed, for lack of a better word, in the cultures. But that it started coming back in the 70s, and that is so important to preserve culture. I get asked to speak every now and then to, like, Boy Scout troops, and I speak about my culture and my background, and they tell them, this is important for you to know your own family history. And I'll have people in the community come to me and say, yeah, my kids came home and said, Mom, where do we come from? What's our cultural identity? You know, and they have to find out so they can tell their kids because they've never thought about it before.
Is the North Dakota Arts Council affected by the fact that its two streams of money come from either Washington or Bismarck, and it's a state agency effectively? Does that affect its work? Does that affect what you say we can support and what we better stay away from?
In certain ways, it does. The first way that it does is under the terms of the National Endowment for the Arts, when they give money to a state, the state has to match it. They have to match that money. And if we don't have the proper backing on the state level to back it, we're going to lose federal money as a result of that. So the state does have to come up with that money. We've never had a problem with it. There's been some challenges, but never been a problem with it. The other thing that affects it is, of course, is publicity, the publicity that certain things in the arts get. I'll mention the Mapplethorpe exhibit from years and years
ago. Yes, the Jesus in the urine jar.
Yes,
that's correct.
Yes, yes. And it got bad publicity. There was another artist in New York some years ago whose medium of choice was manure, but he was painting biblical type scenes with it, and people took exception with that, you know. So I mean, the publicity thing sometimes is what, but arts is about creativity. Arts is about being to express yourself. That's what moves civilization forward.
Well, we have a very new example of what you just spoke about. Sean Belkovich, who's a well-known wet plate photographer in Bismarck, has run into a buzzsaw of opposition to the idea that a wet plate photograph he took of the young woman who's been such an advocate of climate change and
Greta Thunberg,
and apparently it created such a blowback that it won't go on a mural in Bismarck. And art is an expression, it's creation, and sometimes it's edgy, and apparently sometimes it's too edgy.
And I totally agree with you on that, Doug, and I read about that, and I saw some of that, some of the people that expressed their opinions on it, and you're right, art is an expression. Sometimes it does get a little edgy, and sometimes people have exception to it, and I think that there's some politics involved in this as well. And I will go ahead.
Well, isn't part of this tension, though, the fact that art is always pushing a boundary and getting people to talk about why that's a boundary?
Absolutely. Art will always push the boundaries of these kinds of things. And I was going to say that when it comes from the political standpoint of not only in our state but in Washington as well, too, when it comes to discussing the arts, my personal opinion is I don't like to see politics of any kind involved in the arts, because to me, arts are for all of the people, all of the time. And that's the only way I look at it. I myself, I am not politically affiliated in any way. I'm completely independent. And I tell people, I said, I have friends on all sides of the table, and I will make my choices based on what their answers are to the issues that we need to help our country and our state move forward.
I'm often impressed by the idea that political arguments about the arts are sort of bumper stickerish. They're used to incite people's emotions. And if you go to an actual discussion between or among artists, you'll see lots of emotion, but a lot of really deep discussion about why that emotion is there. art is intended to be an emotional experience.
Absolutely. And those people who live it, have that passion for it in their soul, that's where it's coming from. The people that will express something because they read a headline somewhere and say, well, look, they're doing this, they shouldn't do that, you know. Do the research, I always tell the people. Either talk to somebody or do the research. In this day and age, research is a lot easier to do because you don't have to go to a library. Not a knock to libraries, though libraries are still very important, and I love them. But now you can get on the internet and you can find out just about anything you need to know. You don't have to do one source. You can do five. You can do 10. Do the research. If you're going to express an opinion on something, don't come unprepared with just a headline. Have the information.
Well, David White Thunder Trottier, 30 years as a member of the State Arts Board, 22 years as the chair of that board. Now you're no longer with it. Are you unplugged?
Absolutely not. It's like the times I tried to quit playing music and playing in a band. Once something is in your heart and soul, you're never going to be away from it, never unplugged from it. I still play whenever I can. I still write whenever I can. And with the Arts Council, I've met so many wonderfully talented and highly intelligent people over the years, all over this country. And when I decided to do this, I told the current staff and the current Arts Council, I'm only a phone call away. Just give me a call if there's something that you need help with, or you need my opinion on something, or you see what I think about something. Just give me a call. The arts, and as a former athlete, I was a college football player as well, too. Played 4 years at Mayville State.
You were a letter winner.
I was a four-year letter winner, yes. And I said, the arts is something that you can do for the rest of your life. And most people that are involved in the arts do it for their whole life.
Well, I always tell people that one of the reasons I like to act is because it's sort of like being on a football team, but you don't have any threat of head injury.
Right. The only injuries will be emotional.
But it's a highly collaborative experience. It requires a team, and it requires Absolutely. People working in concert for a common purpose. And it's very good that way, and, of course, it's a great way to express yourself, too.
Absolutely. All the years, I have probably 40 shows under my belt as an actor, director in my life. As I said, I hadn't done one in 25 years until 2017 when Rugby revived My Fair Lady and I got to do my Alfred P. Doolittle again.
Oh, right. Wonderful. So what's your next role? Have you been cast in anything?
Well, you know, I've been asked. But I haven't been cast because I remember it's the time commitment that it takes. You do have to have the commitment of the time. And with the other things that I'm getting involved in, it would be hard for me to commit that time at this point in my life. But support them, absolutely.
And, of course, you've still got your radio show.
Absolutely. Every morning, 6 to 10.
All right. David White Thunder Trottier served as the chair of the Board of Directors for the North Dakota Council on the Arts from 1998 until January of this year. David, it's been a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for the opportunity.
Coming up on Main Street, our usual Friday discussion about the news headlines with our news director, Dave Thompson. Then Matt Olin will join us to review Birds of Prey. He'll also share some observations about the Academy Awards. First, the news.
From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald. A member of the North Dakota Public Service Commission says she's hoping to draft an order that could satisfy the concerns of a developer of a proposed wind farm in northern McLean County, as well as fellow state laws concerning light mitigation technology. Prairie Public's Dave Thompson has the story.
The order would concern the proposed Russo Wind Farm. State law requires wind farms permitted after June 2016 to have light mitigating technology on the turbine towers, rather than blinking red lights that are on all the time after dark. The current technology is called aircraft detection lighting systems, which would only turn on the lights when an aircraft is approaching. But representatives of the Air Force object to that system at a wind farm that close to the Minot Air Force Base, and that's holding up the siting permit. The company argues the Federal Aviation Administration has sole control over airspace, and that causes a contradiction with state law. Attorney Molly Smith told the commission the FAA has issued a determination of no hazard based on standard lighting systems, but not on the proposed ADLS. And she says that trumps state law.
Multiple courts have found that the Federal Aviation Act and the regulations enacted pursuant to the act preempt state law with respect to airspace management and air safety based on the supremacy clause.
Smith also argued the statute is vague with regard to lighting technology, and the legislative history shows lawmakers had intended to have exceptions for these kinds of issues. But attorney Brian Johnson, acting for PSC advocacy staff, countered that the plain language of the law should prevail, even after looking at intent.
I think wholeheartedly that if you look at that and apply it and look at the fact that they did consider these things and the law came out the way it did, that this is exactly what their intent is. And I believe that if a court is going to look at it, that's the way they're going to look at it as well.
Commissioner Julie Fedorchak suggested compromise language that could potentially diffuse any conflict between the state law and the FAA.
I just think a reasonable way forward is to include the condition in the permit that they will use this, they will install this technology when it's authorized by the FAA, and even requiring them to be updating us on an annual basis or every 6 months or just some, I'm comfortable with any other conditions that make it clear to the company that the minute that there's a technology that can be used on this site, we expect that it's got to be installed.
The PSC will look at the order at a later meeting. For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
Governor Burgum has appointed Bismarck attorney Bobby Weiler to replace Judge Gail Haggerty on the South Central District bench. Haggerty is retiring in March. Weiler has been in private practice since 2010 and is a partner in the Bismarck law firm of Jackson, Thomason, and Weiler. She graduated from law school at Western Michigan University. For Prairie Public, I'm Todd McDonald.
Well, there's that wire machine in the background. It's time to talk with our news director, Dave Thompson. We do this every Friday and look at the week's big stories. And Dave, one of the week's big stories is one that's been a story for a long time here. Apparently, an agreement has finally been reached over tribal IDs and voting.
It is. And this is a long time coming. And actually, I thought it was kind of a little bit previewed when the governor, in his meeting with the tribal leaders, this conference they held at Bismarck State College, he said it is his administration's goal that everyone who is eligible to vote can vote. So that was the discussion about how they're going to work on things for this statewide 911 system to get people to have the physical address so that they'd meet state law that you have to have your birth date, your name, and your physical address on there. So there was an emergency rule that was promulgated by the Secretary of State's office, and everything seems to be in order. The tribes have agreed to it after kind of a long day or two of mediation, I understand. But now it looks like there is a solution to this.
So what has long been an irritant between the state and the tribal organizations in North Dakota seems to have been eliminated.
It looks like everything is calmed down now, and it looks like natives are going to have the right to vote, and they should have the right to vote.
And, of course, we've got a census coming up, too, and it's important for the state for everybody to be counted.
Absolutely. And, of course, you're talking about 911 addresses. That's one big thing that's an initiative. Say you report a fire, you need an address for the fire truck to get to. So that's why this is also being done at the same time.
Yeah, and, of course, in the 21st century, we've got GPS down to a few feet.
Yes, we do. That's correct.
You had a story earlier this week that really caught my eye. There's a new Environmental Protection Agency lead and copper rule, and it has people in North Dakota concerned, city water utility operators, obviously. It's probably a national issue that people are going to be concerned about.
It is, and as a matter of fact, there was to be a hearing this week in Congress on this particular rule. And I know there's some consternation among cities and among some homeowners because, you know, you've got the water main, and that belongs to the city. And then your tie line belongs to you. Well, now EPA says in order to try to get the lead out of the pipes, they want the cities to come in and inspect it to, you know, the front door of your house, which turns into a real interesting private property dispute.
Yeah, well, and these typically involve homes that were built before 1940 when they were using lead tie lines.
Right, and the cities are saying that they have done a lot in terms of anti-corrosion measures on these pipelines.
Well, this reminds us, of course, of Flint, Michigan.
It does.
A major city in outside of Detroit that is still dealing with this.
Mm-hmm. And to a lesser extent, Brooklyn, New York, too.
So the question is, if there is a lead line out there anywhere, should it not be replaced?
And that's a good point.
Who owns it is probably the issue that's going to have to be decided. And the EPA has said the city is responsible.
Right. And the cities are looking at, and so is the state, they're looking for grant money so that if you've got a home that built before 1940 and you've got one of these lead lines, they're looking for grant money to help you pay the cost of replacement. So that's another thing that's going on at the same time.
Now, Dave, you just filed a story today about Montana Dakota Utilities adding another natural gas unit.
Right.
And they're going to shut down some coal units in a couple of years. And that's a trend that you've been reporting on for some time now.
It is. And you see it now that these kind of things, natural gas is relatively abundant and relatively cheap right now. Wind power is relatively abundant and relatively cheap right now. Coal is starting to almost be priced out of the market because of all the environmental concerns about scrubbing and getting rid of, you know, some of the emissions on coal. So you've got older power plants, for example, Heskett, that's an older power plant that was built in the 1950s. You've got the power plant at Sidney, Montana, built in the 1950s. They're going to shut them down because it, A, is becoming very costly to run, B, they're saying they can get cheaper power other places.
Well, you quote an MDU spokesman as saying it would cost their customers about half as much.
Right.
To make this conversion that those coal plants are pricing themselves out of the market.
Exactly. And now you've got the issue up in Underwood with the Coal Creek Station that's owned by Great River Energy. You know, of course, a lot of that power goes to Minnesota. Minnesota is really on this green energy thing. They're really got new policies for green energy, and it really is causing some concerns that power plant is losing money, and there's going to be some kind of meeting this summer, according to the Bismarck Tribune, where they're going to be talking about, you know, what is the future of the plant, and there's an ethanol plant that's there too. So, you know, there's a lot going on here.
Well, another story that we actually were involved with this week here on Main Street. We talked with Josh Askvig and a national representative of AARP, Josh being the state director,
yes,
about prescription medication costs. And apparently there's some movement happening about that nationally, and it's a big concern for lots of people.
Oh, boy. And that's what I hear a lot when I talk to people out there is the cost of prescription drugs. There is some movement. There's more about how generics are treated by insurance companies, that type of thing. And if you look at Minnesota, and this goes a little bit off field because insulin costs are a real concern. There are competing bills in the Minnesota legislature to deal with some relief for people who are insulin dependent.
Well, the sharp increase in the cost of insulin, and in some cases the availability of it, has really focused attention on, you know, whether this is greed or what.
Exactly.
And the number that Josh was throwing around when we talked earlier this week was that from 2012 to 2017, the cost of prescription drugs overall increased by almost 58% in North Dakota. At the same time, the cost of living in that same period increased by little less than 7%.
Now, so you see why there's a squeeze there between, you know, the cost you're paying out. Even though you may be making more money, you're paying out more.
Yeah, that's an eye-opener, and
it is.
I am hearing that Congress is wrestling with this, that there is bipartisan support for a sort of a federal solution. States are looking at their own options as well, but the Senate has yet to take it up because the Senate leader has simply not introduced it.
That's correct. Yeah,
so political pressure is coming to bear, I think, on
this. I think it is, too.
Let's talk about these human service zones that have been moved around in the state, and now they're in place. They're functioning at an improved level. Is that what the
story is?
Right,
that's correct. It's 19 human service zones now. Each county used to have its own service area, except if they had a couple that did cooperate. But now they're deciding that in a way to get better service at a little less expense, let's do human service zones. Doesn't mean that you can't get services in your county, but in terms of coordination, it's going to be better. It's going to be easier to navigate, perhaps. And that's part of this whole human services reinvention. As the Human Services Department says, let's do it, let's do more, and let's do it more efficiently.
Okay. North Dakota income tax returns are running slightly ahead of last year, a reminder that as spring approaches, so does April 15.
Exactly. Refunds are about the same as last year, but they're a little ahead of last year, and the last report was 66,000 some returns have been filed so far, and they're thinking about 480,000. So.
Okay. Well, it's an important revenue stream for the state.
It certainly is.
One of the three, I guess, legs on the stool.
That's right.
Right.
Income, sales, oil taxes, yes.
Yeah. Okay. Here we go. Let's talk about something that was quite a kerfuffle in Bismarck, and I talked with David White Thunder Trottier about it earlier in our program today. He, of course, stepped down after 30 years on the North Dakota Arts Council, and he was concerned as well by the handling of this Greta Thunberg photo mural in Bismarck. Shane Balkowicz, the wet plate photographer of note, who's actually gotten quite a bit of publicity about this and other
right.
things. And there was blowback in Bismarck.
Right. There's been an effort to kind of beautify downtown Bismarck by putting murals and photos in alleys. And this was going to go to an alley that was outside a bakery, a brand new bakery out there. And oh, it blew up on social media. There were a lot of complaints about it. And Shane Balkowicz decided he was going to abandon Bismarck, and now apparently Fargo is welcoming it.
Well, former City Commissioner Mike Williams says he's lining up the money, and the photo we're talking about is titled Standing With Us All, and mm-hmm. While Balkowicz says he doesn't have a political iron in the fire, is, you know, this
no, it's
is...
it's just a very pretty photograph.
It's a big
says.
Issue, you know.
It is a big issue.
And I think it's apparent that that Greta Thunberg stands for something.
And there's a sad little commentary on that one. He has another... basically depicting the Statue of Liberty, that was defaced overnight.
So. Well, that is a shame. And let's grow up here.
Yeah.
Let's end on a positive note. Giving Hearts Day 2020 was very successful. 500 charities across North Dakota and Northwest Minnesota benefited from more than 34,000 donors, Dave.
That is amazing.
Well, last year, the Giving Hearts Day raised over $16 million, this year over $19
million. That is amazing.
And thanks for joining us, Dave.
Thank you.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
It's time to go to the movies with Matt Olean. And Matt, this week you went to one with a heck of a title, Birds of Prey and the Fantabulous Emancipation of One Harley Quinn.
So this is sort of the sequel to Suicide Squad, which was really attacked by critics and fans alike. But that introduced Margot Robbie as Harley Quinn, who is a great comic book character if you're familiar with the DC Comics universe. She's a great character. Margot Robbie completely inhabits Harley Quinn's character. So that's one thing going for the film. This time, of course, it's going to be the expansion of the all-female superhero group, the Birds of Prey, in the DC Comics. Now, how we get there, as you know, with origin movies, Doug, there's a lot of backstory. And that takes up a lot of time in the first half of the movie as we learn about Huntress, played by Mary Elizabeth Winstead, Detective Renee Montoya, played by Rosie Perez, Black Canary, played by Journey Smollett-Bell, and Cassandra Cain, played by Ella J. Basco. So that's the group. Ewan McGregor is the villain as Roman Sionis. He's very funny, very sinister. The film does have kind of a film noir aspect to it. You know, Sionis has a nightclub where people go. He's up to no good. He tortures people in a very, very awful way, which I won't mention. He's got all kinds of stuff on his mind, like capturing a diamond, and that is where Harley Quinn comes in. Now, the film opens, as you've probably seen in the trailer, with Harley Quinn breaking up with Joker. So Joker's not in the movie, but they're broke up as a couple. So she's on her own, and now she doesn't have that protection. People are coming after her, and that's essentially the plot of the film. The director is Kathy Yan. Good to see a female director directing this movie. That was a big topic on Oscar night, as
you
mentioned.
The writer is also a woman.
Yes, so this was definitely moving in that territory of woman superhero movies like Captain Marvel with Brie Larson. Some critics have liked this film. Some have hated it. Mick LaSalle, a film critic out in San Francisco, called it horrible. I'm in the middle. I did like aspects of the film. I think the action scenes are well done, especially a big fight in an amusement park with the Birds of Prey heroes and Roman's evil men, henchmen. That's well done. Anytime Margot Robbie is on roller skates, it's exciting to watch with carrying her bat around and roller skating as she's hanging onto a car. So I'm in the middle on it. There's a lot of backstory, and that got long and kind of drawn out as we try to learn the backstories of all the women. Harley Quinn kind of narrates the film in sort of a funny, joking way as she introduces you to all of her comrades. She does the introductions. You know, here's Huntress, here's her background. So that's funny as well. But overall, I did like it better than Suicide Squad. But again, it just doesn't do the business that Marvel does. And it was released in February, which is what we're in right now. That's an odd time to release a superhero film. So maybe that kept the box office down. They were hoping for a $50 million weekend. They got $33 million. I can comment as to what I think might be going on there with the box office. But the big thing the film has going for it is Margot Robbie. She is funny as Harley Quinn. She's a loudmouth. She's crazy. And she throws herself into the character. What I like about Margot Robbie is clearly when you see her at the Oscars, she looks like a movie star. Even my wife is just blown away by her physical appearance. That is, you know, undeniable. She looks like a movie star. But what I like about her is she's a character actress.
Yes.
Wolf of Wall Street. I, Tanya, as Tanya Harding. Harley Quinn. Queen Elizabeth in Mary, Queen of Scots.
The recent Fox movie.
Yeah. The only role she's played that sort of trades in on her physical appearance is Bombshell, where she plays the Fox News wannabe anchor, recent Oscar nominee for that. She should have got the Oscar for I, Tanya. I think she's going to eventually win an Oscar because she has the pick of the parts right now. She's a superstar. She's funny. She's engaging. She has almost effortless charisma on screen. So that's what they have going for them in the film. She's the best part of the film.
Well, I think of 20th century Hollywood as almost misogynistic. You
yes.
know? Now, 21st century Hollywood is discovering women in every way.
Yes.
In terms of creating movies.
I think if Margot Robbie would have been a film star 60 years ago, she'd have been pigeonholed in Marilyn Monroe type roles. Mm-hmm. But she's not now. She's talented. Wolf of Wall Street was her breakout performance. But again, why did this film not do so well at the box office? That's an interesting, complicated discussion.
Don't
to
you
have.
Think the people who made the movie tested it and said, we better get it out there?
I don't know. I think that clearly with a female superhero film, they want women to come to the film.
Yes.
But that's generally not again, demographics back this up, not the audience that comes to comic book movies. It's teenage boys and 20-something boys. And again, the early box office demographics are suggesting that they stayed away enough to bring the box office down, and so did female moviegoers. So it's an interesting dichotomy at work here. I wish the film would have been more successful. It's better than Suicide Squad. Margot Robbie, if you look at her IMDb page, she is under contract to play Harley Quinn in a new Suicide Squad film. There's a rumored film with her and the Joker. Presumably that'll be Jared Leto, not Joaquin Phoenix, because the Phoenix Joker almost feels like a whole different movie than a comic book movie. So where this goes from here, we'll see. We've seen films that did not do well at the box office. And when I say not do well, $33 million is still a good weekend.
Well, I would imagine it cost a fair amount to make it.
Yes, I'm sure it did. And again, I liked it enough. I think people should see it. It's not a great film. There's a lot of backstory, probably too much backstory. But Margot Robbie is the reason to go.
Okay. Let's talk about the Academy Awards last Sunday. I have to be right up front with you. I haven't watched the Academy Awards in years, and it's partly because I kind of look at the business as that. It's mm-hmm. I know that people can argue about art and creativity and all that kind of thing, but to me, it's corporate creativity, if you will. Nevertheless, what was your take on who won?
So I'll get to that in a second. You're right about not watching. You are a trend because they had the lowest ratings in years, ever, that they've ever had. Now, we have a lot of choices out there on your TV channel.
Yes.
And that's part of what's driving it. It's still a highly rated show, but all award shows are dropping in numbers. Friends of mine who are casual film goers have told me repeatedly they don't like the politics with the speeches. They don't like a lot of that stuff. So that keeps people away, in my opinion. I still watch, of course. So that being said, Parasite's a great film. I did predict Bong Joon-ho would get director on this show, but I thought 1917 would get picture. That's the one I got wrong. Clearly, when Parasite won the screenplay Oscar over Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, you could tell it was going to be a big night. And by the end, Bong Joon-ho was holding four Oscars, which is just a crazy great night for him.
And a great night for foreign film directors and creators, you know.
First foreign language film to ever win Best Picture. That's a big deal. Look, as I said, they couldn't go wrong with any of the big three. 1917, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, Parasite are all Best Picture quality films. So any of those choices would have been fine. All the acting awards went right as I predicted. I didn't have any problem with any of them. Joaquin Phoenix is the right choice. Brad Pitt's the right choice. Zellweger was great as Judy Garland. I would have liked to seen, you know, Zha Zhu Zhen from The Farewell in supporting actress to give Laura Dern some competition. But overall, I think they got it right with most of the awards.
Was there a surprise for you? I mean, best zipper?
You know, maybe a slight surprise. By the way, cinematography was a lock. Roger Deakins got cinematography. You said that.
I think
last
that one
week.
Will last for a long time. That's sort of like Citizen Kane's famous film cinematographer.
Right. But I remember on the show, you thought Mendes would get director, and I said Bong Joon-ho. I just felt like it was Bong Joon-ho's time to get that award.
And where I would have argued there, and I would still argue, that is to do what Sam Mendes did with Richard Deakins is directions.
Roger Deakins.
Is like almost like stage directing.
It is.
Because you had to do this in, you know, like a take.
Yeah.
Not the whole movie, obviously. There were edits in it, but there were long stretches that were absolutely choreographed.
Yeah.
I mean, amazingly.
There were almost no surprises except maybe Ford versus Ferrari beating Parasite for film editing. But when you watch Ford versus Ferrari, you can see why it would win film editing and sound mixing, which it got as well. Nice to see Once Upon a Time in Hollywood get a second award along with Pitt for production design, because that recreation of Los Angeles 1969 was just breathtaking.
Yeah, I lived through it, so
okay,
it struck me as pretty authentic. We've been to the movies with Matt O'Lean.
Love is in the air. The Bismarck Mandan Civic Chorus invites you to Valentine Cabaret on Friday, February 14th at 7 p.m. at the National Energy Center at Bismarck State College. Along with performances of favorite love songs, the event will feature a Valentine dinner, wine tasting, private serenades, and silent auction baskets. Tickets must be purchased in advance and are available from chorus members or online at bismanchorus.com. More information by calling 701-400-7774.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 17th. Alfred Dickey was the first Lieutenant Governor of North Dakota. He was also a citizen of Jamestown and a supporter of the public good. So in January of 1901, he called a meeting with the intention to create a free reading room for Jamestown. Unfortunately, Mr. Dickey proved too sick to go to his own meeting, so he was represented by his friend, Mr. Smart. It was through Smart that the attendees learned that Mr. Dickey intended to donate most of the supplies needed for the new room and would even hire a custodian for three nights a week. Unfortunately, Mr. Dickey couldn't shake his illness, and 3 days after the meeting, he died without ever seeing his idea come to fruition. Shortly after his death, his son, Alfred E. Dickey held another meeting with the library committee and guaranteed them that he would fulfill his father's promises. About a month later, around this date, Jamestown happily opened the reading room in the Opera House block, leaving it free and open to the public, although for $1 a year, library card holders could borrow books from there. This spot proved popular, and in 1908, the city decided to support the library with taxes, and in January 1909, they moved it to City Hall and hired the first full-time librarian, Miss Alice Paddock. Alfred E. Dickey continued to support the library even after his death in 1910, leaving the board of directors $20,000 to find a new library location and a $15,000 endowment for upkeep of the building. In 1980, the National Register of Historic Places registered the Alfred Dickey Free Library as a historical site. They have since received two more endowments, one of $13,000 from Morris Beck and another of $20,000 from Chester Hodge for buying books of nonfiction. However, the largest support comes from the taxes and generous donations from the people of Jamestown and Stutsman County. So even though Alfred Dickey never saw the fruits of his idea, there's no doubt about the impact of his vision. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Lucid Thomas. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Saturday, one man on being evacuated from China during the coronavirus outbreak. Nevada prepares for caucuses, tries not to pull an Iowa. And our Eric Thomas says we can't pin our hopes on a speedy apocalypse.
I can't wake up every morning and think, well, we're only in 3 days till doomsday. Like, what's the point of that? Why get out of bed at all?
His memoir and more, Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
7 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Monday is President's Day, and we'll share an encore episode of Main Street. Presidential scholar Rick Cullen of Bismarck visits with David Eisenhower, co-author of Going Home to Glory, a memoir of life with Dwight D. Eisenhower. David is the grandson of the famous general and president. Also contributing to the book was David's wife, Julie Nixon Eisenhower, daughter of President Richard Nixon. And nominations are being sought for the 2020 class of inductees to the North Dakota Native American Hall of Honor. On Monday, we'll go back to the Hall of Honor's first year, 2016, with comments from Scott Hall, Executive Director of the North Dakota Indian Affairs Commission, and we'll listen to a profile of the very first inductee, Anthony McDonald. And Main Street Weekend, Sunday morning, will feature two men who've spent a lot of time chronicling small towns in North Dakota. Dirk Wieringa is working on a documentary about U.S. Highway 2, and Jim Puffy has published a book featuring people in every town in the state that's shown on the North Dakota highway map. Main Street Weekend airs Sunday morning at 10 Central. We hope you can join us for Main Street. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.